Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some current events, of course, lots of politics, and some Hollywood news for you. We are starting with a Hollywood story and a sad one. Michael Madsen, most ferocious of the Reservoir Dogs, dies at 67. The actor leaves a legacy of gruff, hard-knock ruffians and at one utterly blood-curdling sociopath. This is by Anthony Bresnahan on July 3rd. By most accounts, Michael Madsen was a warm and loving man, and his unexpected death at the age of 67 has led to an outpouring of affection and respect for the late actor. But he made his name playing the opposite: tough guys, sons of bitches, and outright villains. One character stands above them all as the most harrowing: Mr. Blonde from Reservoir Dogs. Before that 1992 crime thriller, which vaulted a jittery young video store clerk named Quentin Tarantino into becoming one of the most premier filmmakers of his era, Madsen was a workaday actor, starting out with bit parts on TV shows like St. Elsewhere, Miami Vice, and Quantum Leap. In 1991, he stood out as Jim Morrison's confidant and booze hound buddy in Oliver Stone's The Doors and Susan Sarandon's love-struck musician boyfriend in Thelma and Louise. Then came Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs, a scrappy little indie flick from a nobody director which immortalized Madsen as the cold-blooded career criminal and conscience-free killer Mr. Blonde. No one who watches that film will ever forget the ear scene in which Blonde tortures a captive police officer played by Kirk Baltz after a heist gone wrong. He's not trying to do anything, actually. He'd like to know who ratted out the team of color-coded crooks, but he's really inflicting suffering just for fun. As Steeler's Wheels' 1972 bop Stuck in the Middle with You plays on the radio, Madsen dances and sings along. The muffled cop, lashed to his chair in the center of the warehouse, can't take his eyes off the straight razor in his captive's hands. In the script, it said, "Mr. Blonde maniacally dances around," Madsen said in a 2017 cast reunion at the Tribeca Film Festival. "I remember specifically that's what it said, and I remember thinking, what the fuck does that mean? Mick Jagger? What the fuck am I going to do? He trusted me on the day that I would come up with something." Madsen went understated. A little shuffle, a sway of the hips, and then Mr. Blonde lunges, sawing at the police officer's head like a hungry man digging into a porterhouse steak. It's so savage and sadistic that even the camera can't bear to look. Tarantino abruptly steers it away from the bloody disfigurement happening just to the right. "In my film, I want it to hurt," Tarantino said in a 1992 Associated Press interview. "People tell me they've had bad dreams after they saw the movie. That's exactly what I want. I'm interested in outrageous violence, because outrageous violence is real violence." That moment would have been bad enough, but Madsen takes it to an even more incandescently evil place. The mask cop whimpers, and Mr. Blonde returns to his jocularity, lifting the severed ear to his mouth and speaking into it. "Hey, what's going on?" He flashes a smile. It seems genuine. He's having a good time. The audience is crawling out of their seats, if not their skin. It's revolting, it's unsettling, and it's so dark that it comes around full circle into the absurd. Madsen took Tarantino's twisted scenario and created one of the most memorable and despicable villains of all time. The role made Madsen a star, and he would work again with Tarantino repeatedly over the years in the two Kill Bill films, The Hateful Eight and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, always bringing raspy charm to his rough-and-tumble characters he inhabited on screen. It wasn't easy for him. Madsen was later the father of six sons, but at the time, he had only his firstborn, who was still a toddler. When Baltz's captive cop tries to save his own life by begging that he has a son, Tarantino remembered that getting under the actor's skin. Madsen himself noted at the 2017 reunion that despite a lifetime of hundreds of movies and TV shows, the one fans consistently wanted to talk to him about remained Reservoir Dogs. "I started imagining myself at 80 years, you know, and someone asking me to do the Mr. Blonde dance," he said. It's been following me around forever. In other news, Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez ripped one major wedding detail straight from Prince William and Kate Middleton. Imitation is sincerest form of flattery. The newlyweds, who tied the knot in Venice last week, had the same musical guest and the same key song. This is by Blanche Marcel on July 3rd. Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez said, "I do," last weekend in romantic Venice. The newlyweds celebrated their union in a wedding which ran them an estimated $50 million. Long anticipated, the wedding lived up to all its promises: couture gowns by Schiaparelli, an extravagant yacht, the city of water as a private setting, hand-picked guests, and, of course, a musical program worthy of the greatest of stages. The couple invited British singer Ellie Goulding to perform at the reception on June 27th. The choice echoes that of Kate Middleton and Prince William, who also invited the artist to their wedding reception in 2011, hosted by King Charles III. For that occasion, the artist performed a highly personal version of Your Song, the classic by John, who was a close friend of Princess Diana. "Performing the first dance of the night, Your Song was nerve-wracking," she told the Daily Mail in 2012, "but William and Kate were very appreciative. They're an awesome couple and told me how much they enjoyed it. My band and I stayed at the reception all night, and it's something I'll treasure forever." The performance continued with Starry Eyed and a cover of The Killers' Mr. Brightside. Almost 14 years later, Goulding once again chose Your Song to accompany the Bezos couple's debut. Matteo Bocelli, son of Andrea Bocelli, also sang at the ceremony. A few weeks before the festivities, a British source revealed that Lady Gaga and Elton John were invited to perform, but it didn't materialize. A last-minute hitch, perhaps. A host of celebrities made the trip to Italy to attend the union of Mr. and Mrs. Bezos: Oprah Winfrey, Orlando Bloom, the Kardashian and Jenner sisters, Leonardo DiCaprio, Usher, Bill Gates, and François-Henri Pinault were among the guests. The pomp and circumstance of the wedding was reminiscent of that of Princess Diana and Prince Charles on July 29, 1981. "It's going to be like a Princess Di thing," Sanchez's older brother Paul predicted to TMZ in March. "It's going to be an amazing event. There'll be lots of fun and star-studded." He wasn't wrong. It's just one more thing they have in common with the royals. In other celebrity news, Dakota Johnson enjoys yachts and time with Kate Hudson after Chris Martin breakup. During a trip to a local hotspot, the pair also ran into Ricky Martin. This is by Marita Alonso on July 3rd. Longtime friends Dakota Johnson and Kate Hudson are enjoying a few days of vacation together in Ibiza. Their trip recalls another one back in 2015 when both actors, as well as their famous mothers, Melanie Griffith and Goldie Hawn, respectively, enjoyed a few days together in Aspen. When Hudson, who is a musician in addition to being an actor, gave a concert in the same Colorado city last year, Johnson didn't miss it. So it's not all strange to see the two of them on a trip, which, in addition to yacht rides, has had room for some surprise. While dining at the well-known restaurant Perluigi with businessman Douglas Chabot and Johnson's agent Maha Dakil, they ran into Ricky Martin. The singer, single after his split from Juan Yosef, appeared with an attractive young man, causing someone to wonder if the Livin' La Vida Loca star has found love again. The bohemian looks the friends opted for on their Italian adventure seemed worthy of an early aughts rom-com, a genre Hudson is well acquainted with. Johnson, who wore a boho bodhi top to their dinner, only reinforced the romantic comedy vibe. Now the actors have been photographed on a yacht in Ibiza with Hudson's stylist, Sophie Lopez. While Dakota opted to wear a white bikini, Hudson went for a yellow look with a cherry print. Johnson seems to be enjoying her trip to Ibiza, which comes after her high-profile breakup with her longtime partner, Coldplay frontman Chris Martin. Heading to Ibiza after a split is always a great idea, and doing it in the company of a close friend is even better. There's been a lot going on this week. Sean Diddy Combs found not guilty of racketeering and sex trafficking. The verdict capped over a year of intense public turmoil for the era-defining hip-hop mogul, who was convicted on two lesser prostitution counts. This is by Dan Adler on July 2nd. At a May news conference in the Oval Office, Donald Trump looked coy as he mused about whether he would hypothetically pardon Sean Diddy Combs. "Nobody's asked," he told reporters, "but I know people are thinking about it." Trump said he would look at the facts and that while he was aware of Combs speaking out against him in the time since he entered politics, it wouldn't affect his thinking. He reminded the press that he and Combs go back sometime, recalling, "He used to really like me a lot." In the end, it's a decision he will likely not have to make. After a 2-month trial and about 13 hours of deliberations, on Wednesday, a Manhattan jury found Combs not guilty on racketeering and sex trafficking charges, the most severe counts he's faced. Jurors found Combs guilty of 2 counts of prostitution, comparatively minor charges. The verdict represents a major victory for Combs. According to reporters in the courthouse, he pumped his fist as the verdict was read. On X, former federal prosecutor Nia Ramani described the case as the most expensive prostitution trial in American history. In rising from record label intern to the highest rungs of American celebrity, Combs played an era-defining role in the development of hip-hop music and the cultural and business mechanisms surrounding it, fashion, marketing, television, and gossip. He and Trump were a natural pair in the New York 90s, and they both played the relationship up as a marker of their shared appetites for conquest. The verdict caps a near-total revision of Combs' image. In October 2023, his former longtime girlfriend, Cassandra Cassie Ventura, sued him for physical and sexual abuse in a civil complaint so gruesome that it began with a trigger warning. The suit also introduced the term freak-off, an elaborate sexual performance orchestrated by Combs as a byword for the mogul's long-studied personal life. While Combs and Ventura quickly settled, with Combs admitting no wrongdoing at the time, the broader turmoil was already underway. Combs is also denied wrongdoing in a wave of civil suits filed against him, but offered a halting video apology when surveillance footage surfaced of him beating Ventura in a hotel hallway. Ventura was the star witness in the criminal case that federal prosecutors brought against Combs, and the assault figured prominently in their claim that Combs' freak-offs, portrayed by defense lawyers as a lifestyle choice, were at root a product of violent coercion. As he paced in front of the jury during his closing remarks on Friday, Combs' attorney, Mark Agnifilo, conceded that his client had physically abused Ventura. "We own the domestic violence," he said. "But Combs did not do the things he's charged with," Agnifilo went on. "He didn't kidnap anybody. He didn't obstruct justice. He didn't bribe anybody." In large part, Agnifilo mocked the investigation into Combs' sex life, his voice often rising to an indignant squeal. Even by the standards of celebrity sex trials, interest in the proceedings against Combs sometimes took on a decidedly frivolous quality, contrasting the grave tenor that has occupied the high-profile sexual misconduct cases brought against powerful men in recent years. Outside the courthouse, among the throngs of live streamers documenting each glimpse into Combs' sex life, some onlookers wore T-shirts reading, "A Freako is not a Rico." In her rebuttal, Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Maureen Comey, sought to refocus the stakes. She said that Combs thought of himself as he rose in fame and success as untouchable. "The defendant never thought," Comey said, "that the women he abused would have the courage to speak out loud what he had done to them." And in other true crime, Brian Koberger, likely to spend the rest of his life in one of the worst prisons in America. True crime obsessives were gearing up for the trial of the century. Instead, admitted University of Idaho mass killer Brian Koberger will live out his days in a prison far from the spotlight. This is by Eve Beatty on July 6th. The booming business of true crime suffered a setback last week when Brian Koberger, the man accused of the 2022 mass slaying of University of Idaho students Kaylee Gonglaves, Ethan Chapin, Zaina Kernodle, and Madison Mogan, changed his plea to guilty. Social media users who built their summers around commenting on or even traveling to his trial appear at a loss, seemingly unaware that August in Idaho is far less fun than it sounds. But those whose business model revolves around online speculation about every move Brian Koberger makes will only have one more chance. His sentencing hearing on July 23rd, after which he's expected to serve 4 consecutive life sentences at the Idaho Maximum Security Institution, notorious as one of the most unpleasant prisons in the U.S., and is a place where visitors are tightly restricted. Koberger likely made that plea deal to avoid the death penalty, but it also had an unintended consequence. It's put an end point on a media circus that's plagued Moscow, Idaho since November 13, 2022, when four students were stabbed to death in their college residence. In the days that followed, amateur sleuths descended on the small town, virtually and in person, falsely identifying suspects and spinning theories. It was professional detective work and science that led police to their suspect, not TikTok. Genetic genealogy tools were used to link DNA on a knife sheath to Koberger, a PhD student in criminology at nearby Washington State University. That discovery was made almost 7 weeks after the crime, and by then, rumors had reached a fever pitch. Koberger's arrest did little to quell the media obsession with the case, as Kathleen Hale reported for Vanity Fair at the time. That he stood silent instead of entering a plea when he was arraigned in a 2023 took speculation to yet another level. By the end of 2023, the house where Gonglaves, Chapin, Kernodle, and Mogan died had been demolished, an effort, University of Idaho officials said, to decrease further impact on the students who live in that area. The vacant residence has become a true crime tourism destination, as well as a stop for certain types of social media users. It was also the grim reminder of the heinous act that took place there, University of Idaho President Scott Green said in a statement. That left Koberger, as the sole remaining representation of the crime, as conspiracy theorists grew inflamed by delays for his trial. But a little more than a week ago, 4th District Judge Stephen Hippler ruled that a delay requested by Koberger's defense team was denied, and opening new arguments would begin on August 18th. Hippler even acknowledged at the time, between his arrest and trial, are why misinformation and conspiracy theories continue to circulate. The longer the public is made to sit and wait for the facts to come out at trial, the more time there is for inflammatory, speculative stories, movies, and books to circulate, and more time for prior ones to be rebroadcast, purchased, viewed, and consumed by the public, he wrote. Koberger's plea arguably turns that fire hose of content off, or at least way down, and his incarceration should slow it to a trickle. In Idaho, people convicted of crimes as serious as his are typically sent to IMSI, which per its website is intended to confine Idaho's most disruptive male residents. According to the Idaho Statesman, the Kuna, Idaho prison was the site of an inmate uprising last year over claims of filth, lack of medical care, and mandated recreation time spent instead in cages. Claims about conditions within the maximum security facility were considered serious enough that the prison scored a spot on Security Journal America's 2024 list of the 15 worst prisons in America. It's also a place where true crime podcasters and their ilk are unlikely to tread, assuming Koberger agreed to their interview. Unlikely. According to the Idaho Department of Corrections, anyone who seeks to visit any of IMSI's 549 inmates must first submit to a background check and submit a visiting application. If approved, the rules get even stricter. The only personal possessions visitors are allowed are their photo identification, money for vending machines, and their car keys. Layered looks, such as coats or sweatshirts over t-shirts, are not allowed, as the outer garments could conceal contraband. Most importantly, no cell phones, beepers, laptop, palm computers, cameras, or other electronic equipment is allowed, which means no recordings, no selfies, and if you're stuck in a pre-visit line or a waiting area, which in my experience often happens, no phone to scroll through while you cool your heels. You're trapped with your own thoughts, sometimes for hours. One wonders how many aspiring true crime influencers could handle such a challenge. In other news from the Hollywood section, Trainwreck, Poop Cruise captivates an emotionally exhausted America. The latest episode of Netflix's docuseries about spiraling disasters and epic fails feels like a metaphor for, well, everything. This is by Eve Beatty on June 29th. There is no coincidence, only the illusion of coincidence. Alan Moore famously wrote, while the V for Vendetta author wasn't referring directly to Trainwreck, Poop Cruise, when he had freedom fighter V make that remark, it's hard not to think about how Moore's dystopian epic this week. After all, the show is about a feces-filled cruise ship, is at the top of Netflix's movie rankings at exactly the same time as an oligarch famous for allegedly expecting workers to pee in bottles took over a city known for its problematic sewage system to hold an estimated $50 million wedding. Coincidence? I still don't know her, but I do know a lot of us are feeling like shit these days. How can we not? The streaming series, which shouldn't be confused with the Amy Schumer rom-com of the same name, launched June 10th with an episode about the November 5th, 2021 fatal crowd crush during Travis Scott's Astroworld Festival in which 8 people were killed. Dark stuff, maybe too dark for the same week, we watch President Donald Trump send masked troops into L.A. in a scene that evoked Damon Lindelof's reboot of Moore's Watchmen as much as anything. The next episode, about late Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, felt almost quaint. It feels like a lifetime since a one-time Toronto mayor who left office over allegations of crack use was in the news. It was 2014. Damian Lewis played Ford in a movie released in 2019. I don't remember it, do you? I do, however, remember the ill-fated Carnival Triumph cruise from 2013, in which a 2-day trip from Galveston, Texas to Cozumel, Mexico, turned ugly when an engine room fire stopped the ship in its tracks. For 3 days, about 4,100 passengers and crew were adrift in the Gulf of Mexico. There goes my Oval Office access, without electricity, which meant the ship's toilets could not flush. And now you know why. It's called Poop Cruise. The question of where to eliminate solid waste when the primary receptacles are out of order dominates much of the hour-long episode, as does the discomfort one experiences without air conditioning or fresh food. The vessel was stocked with non-perishable goods that helped sustain the trapped passengers and crew. More food and other necessities were brought on board as it was towed to shore. No one died or even suffered serious injury, though a passenger who spoke with SWNS claims trauma so deep that they'll never cruise again. Poop Cruise is a pleasant enough way to while 45 minutes away under the days-long heat dome, a weather condition caused by, scientists say, the rapidly worsening climate crisis. At least we aren't stuck on a boat in the Gulf, as we mutter as we click play. As the episode rolls, we can even scroll through the images of private plane-flying B-listers and Oprah Winfrey in all of her Phil McGraw and Mehmet Oz boosting glory. Celebrating the founder of what's reportedly one of the world's most notable polluters. In 2013, it was 4,100 people on a poop cruise, but today, it just might be all of us. Next up, stars pack Wimbledon. Cate Blanchett, Dave Grohl, John Cena, Princess Beatrice, and more. Other celebrities at the storied tennis tournament included Russell Crowe, Eddie Redmayne, and Leslie Mann. This is by Eve Beatty on July 5th. Held since 1877, the Wimbledon Championships have held a reputation as a place to see and be seen. Unique for quirks like its grass court and ban on nighttime matches, its June through July schedule also guarantees a certain glow from spectators, many of whom spend most of their days with creature comforts such as shade and air conditioning. Add to that the All England Lawn Tennis Club's smart casual code, which eschews athleisure in favor of suits and dresses, and you've got a prescription for some hot, in the literal sense, celebrities, as well as some unexpected groupings. For example, see the photo above for the matchup of John Cena and wife Shay Sharitsta next to Foo Fighter Dave Grohl and Jordan Bloom. It's a surreal pairing worthy of Peacemaker Season 3. Cate Blanchett took a seat between her mother, June Blanchett, and Rebel Wilson. The Australians were seated in the Royal Box, an invitation-only zone reserved for British and overseas royal families, heads of government, people from the world of tennis, commercial partners, British armed forces, prominent media organizations, supporters of British tennis, and other walks of life, per Wimbledon's website. As Blanchett played Queen Elizabeth I twice, her inclusion seemed inevitable. Olivia Rodrigo was already in the UK for her set at Glastonbury, so it makes sense that she'd build a stop at Wimbledon into this trip, with her boyfriend Paddington 2's Luis Partridge in tow. Just next to Rodrigo and Partridge, erstwhile Howard Stark, Dominic Cooper, sat next to Priyanka Chopra Jones and husband Nick Jonas. Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann are frequent courtside fixtures at NBA matchups. In fact, the married couple's first date was at a basketball game. Nice to see the pair spicing things up with a different sport. The arrival of Princess Beatrice of York and Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York, was a big news, as Ferguson's last Wimbledon outing was reportedly in 2000, and that year she wasn't seated in the royal box. According to People, she's been absent from those select seats since 1988 when she attended the tournament with Princess Diana. Eddie Redmayne looked very Day of the Jackal when he rolled into Wimbledon on day one. Also in tow, singer Molly King and Redmayne's wife, Hannah Bagshaw. The couple has actual tennis street cred, as in recent years they've also been spotted at the U.S. Open in New York and the 2025 French Open just last month. Unlike most folks dressed for a day in the summer heat, Russell Crowe opted for a dark-colored suit when he attended with fiancée Brittany Thiriot. Then again, can the sun compare to the unpleasant heat Crowe experienced during the appearance in Kraven the Hunter? Unlikely. Want to feel old? That fully formed, nearly adult human next to Jessica Alba is her 17-year-old daughter, Honor Warren. Time is indeed a flat circle. Our next headline is from the media section, which is going to kind of pivot us toward politics. No one is happy about it. CBS staffers were tired of the Paramount drama, but the settlement intensifies media capitulation concerns. As Elizabeth Warren calls for an investigation, staffers within the news division of the media giant have expressed a combination of disappointment and acceptance over a settlement with Donald Trump that was out of their hands. This is by Natalie Korak on July 2nd. Enough is enough. That was the sentiment from inside CBS, one staffer told Vanity Fair, as Paramount reached a settlement agreement on Tuesday with the Trump administration, a move broadly criticized as capitulation. Inside the news institution, which has been rattled by the drawn-out legal saga, executive departures, and claims of editorial interference, all in the context of a looming sale to Skydance, people are ready to move on. Meanwhile, Senator Elizabeth Warren plans to drag the fight to Congress, calling for an investigation into the settlement. It's been something that's lasted so long as a trauma, added the source. And yet, according to this source, the general sense is no one is happy about it. In a near-midnight agreement on Tuesday, Paramount settled the defamation lawsuit launched over the editing of a pre-election interview on 60 Minutes featuring then-Vice President Kamala Harris. Under the terms, Paramount has agreed to pay a total of $16 billion, all of which will be allocated to his future presidential library, minus legal fees. In a statement, Paramount specified that the settlement does not include a statement of apology or regret. However, going forward, 60 Minutes will release transcripts of interviews with eligible U.S. presidential candidates after such interviews have aired. Warren called for an investigation into the network settlement Wednesday, arguing that this could be bribery in plain sight. She added that Paramount should be ashamed of putting its profits over independent journalism. Warren also emphasized the glaring need for rules to restrict donations to sitting presidents' libraries, and she will soon be introducing legislation to rein in corporations. Senator Bernie Sanders also released a statement slamming the settlement, characterizing Trump's defamation lawsuit as bogus, and arguing that the Redstone family diminished the freedom of the press today in exchange for a $2.4 billion payday. I'm going to pause here to remind you you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Let's continue. Companies often settle litigation to avoid the high and somewhat unpredictable costs of legal defense, the risk of an adverse judgment that could result in significant financial or reputational damage, and the disruption to business operations that prolonged legal battles can cause. A Paramount Global spokesperson said in a statement to Vanity Fair in response to concerns of bribery. Settlement offers a negotiated resolution that allows companies to focus on their core objectives rather than being mired in uncertainty and distraction. In a news story reporting the settlement, Benjamin Mullen, Michael Greenbaum, Lauren Hirsch, and David Einrich of the New York Times called the agreement an extraordinary concession to a sitting president by a major media organization, as well as the clearest sign yet that Mr. Trump's ability to intimidate major American institutions extends to the media industry. The Writers Guild of America East, which represents many staffers at CBS News, torched the settlement as a transparent attempt to curry favors with an administration in the hopes it will allow the Paramount Global and Skydance Media merger to be cleared for approval. Paramount's decision to capitulate to Trump threatens journalists' ability to do their job reporting on powerful public figures. Reporters Without Borders, an international nonprofit organization, called the settlement a shameful decision by Redstone and the company. A line is being drawn between the owners of American news media who are willing to stand up for press freedom and those who capitulate to the demands of the president. Inside the CBS newsroom, CBS News president and executive editor Tom Sabrowski addressed the settlement on Wednesday's editorial call, emphasizing that CBS News was not required to apologize as part of the agreement, according to CNN's Brian Stelter. Sabrowski's comments included some words of appreciation for CBS News staffers, thanking them for blocking out the noise during the legal turmoil. The staffer tells me that while people aren't happy about the idea of settling, there's sadness about it. There's also an acceptance that for 99% of people, this is out of their hands. The lawsuit has generated significant upheaval within CBS News, with the resignation of 60 Minutes executive producer Bill Owens, who cited the inability to make independent decisions about the program as reasoning for his exit amid looming legal challenges. Just 1 month later, the president of CBS News, Wendy McMahon, departed the network, telling staffers in a memo that it's become clear the company and I do not agree on the path forward. Meanwhile, Paramount is in the midst of completing a multi-billion-dollar sale to Skydance, which would take the financial pressure off of chair and controlling shareholder of Paramount, Sherry Redstone, and place the company in the hands of Skydance CEO David Ellison. Just last month, Fox Business senior correspondent Charles Gasparino told me in an interview that Redstone has a huge tax bill. She's wrapped up in this melting ice cube of a company. He added that Skydance isn't interested in the company for the news network. The business that they're arguing over is something that could go away in literally 3 or 5 years. A source close to Redstone tells me that she very much recused herself from the settlement negotiation process, adding that she would be an idiot to play a role. According to the source, Redstone signaled that she would like to settle, but left the specifics of the settlement up to mediators. I don't think she was heavy-handed in the negotiations, nor would it be prudent for her to have been, they added. Meanwhile, Redstone is also battling thyroid cancer and has been totally focused on her health, even though this whole situation might have, in her mind, caused her cancer from all the stress, the source said. While some were shocked that Puck reported that Redstone was not on the list for this year's Allen & Co. conference in Sun Valley, Idaho, an annual event frequented by media moguls and billionaires, the source noted that her absence was simply because of health. We are pivoting to the politics section. Our first headline, Elon Musk, encouraged by Mark Cuban and Anthony Scaramucci, says he's starting a new political party. Today, the America Party, is formed to give you back your freedom, the ex-right-hand man of Donald Trump and the richest person in the world wrote on his social media site. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on July 6th. Mark Cuban, the billionaire who was reportedly all in for Kamala Harris in October of last year, is now one of the people all in for a new political party, run by another billionaire, Elon Musk. Musk, the richest person in the world who recently left his helm as the right-hand man for President Donald Trump after feuding over the GOP's pricey funding package, announced on his social media site Saturday that he is creating the America Party. The high-profile separation has included Trump hinting that the administration would take a look at deporting Musk, suggesting that Trump was in the Epstein files, and the pair generally warring online. Independence Day is the perfect time to ask if you want independence from the two-party, some would say uniparty, system. Musk wrote on Friday over a poll asking, should we create the America Party? Over 65% of respondents said yes. By a factor of 2-1, you want a new political party and you shall have it, Musk posted the next day, adding, today the America Party is formed to give you back your freedom. As of Saturday evening, he has not filed paperwork for the new party. If Musk were to form a new entity, it would have to be disclosed to the Federal Election Commission. Cuban wrote to Musk, the CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, on X, saying that though his work with the Center for Competitive Democracy, he can help get the America Party on ballots. That is their mission, Cuban, who the New York Times called a prolific and vocal supporter of Harris, wrote. Along with Cuban, Anthony Scaramucci, who spent 11 days as Trump's communication director in 2017, social media personality Brian Kassenstein, and Tyler Palmer, a tech investor who was the first employee at Patreon, also expressed support for Musk's plan. Throughout Saturday and into Sunday, Musk continued to post about forming the new party, sharing several memes, including one with his face superimposed onto Uncle Sam. In that post, created by Tesla owners Silicon Valley, it states the America Party would focus, among other things, on adding more AI and robots into the military, decreasing regulation, and supporting a pro-natalist agenda. The way we're going to crack the uniparty system is by using a variant of how Epaminondas shared the myth of Spartan invincibility at Leuctra, Musk posted on X. Extremely concentrated force at a precise location on the battlefield. This strategy in practice, he explained, could be to laser focus on just 2 or 3 Senate seats and 8 to 10 House districts. Musk, born in South Africa in 1971, acquired Canadian citizenship through his mother in 1988, moved to the U.S. in 1992, and became a naturalized citizen in 2002. While he is not eligible to run for president, the billionaire has made it clear that he's willing to shell out immense amounts of money to get who he wants in office. Before their feud, Musk contributed at least $260 million toward efforts to send Trump back to the White House, according to FEC filings. He's also promised $1 million checks to certain voters on multiple occasions to draw attention to the candidates he supports. In the spring, Musk poured more than $20 million into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race to back right-wing Waukesha County Judge Brad Schimmel. His efforts were unsuccessful as Wisconsin voters opted for Dane County Judge Susan Crawford and maintained the court's liberal majority. With few billionaires like Cuban in his corner, it's unclear just how much financial help could be behind the America Party. During his blip as one of, if not the, most powerful person in Trump's ear, Musk illustrated how much he thinks Washington ought to run, ideas that have already come with immense consequences for Americans across the country and people around the world. When Musk was still presiding over the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, the new agency, in coordination with other parts of Trump's administration, laid off hundreds of staffers at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, fostered chaos at the Department of Veterans Affairs through canceled contracts, hiring freezes, and layoffs, and attempted to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, amongst other decisions, the ripple effects of which may not be known for years. Our next headline, guess who's paying for part of President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill? The president signed the GOP-led package of tax and spending cuts, which includes new fees on immigrants, both documented and not. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on July 5th. President Donald Trump signed the GOP's massive tax and funding cuts bill into law on July 4th, meeting his self-imposed deadline in an outdoor ceremony attended by hundreds of supporters and military jets flying over the White House. The newly minted law will fund many of Trump's domestic policies, including his immigration crackdown, resulting in nearly $170 billion to support the administration's border goals. The final bill, as detailed by NPR, allocates $45 billion for immigration detention centers, around $30 billion to hire more immigration and customs enforcement personnel for transportation costs and to maintain ICE facilities. Additionally, roughly $46.5 billion has been earmarked to complete Trump's border wall, a campaign promise he's been repeating for nearly a decade, and includes $5 billion for customs and border protection facilities and $10 billion for other border security initiatives. Approximately $13.5 billion will be set aside to reimburse states and local governments for their assistance with immigration and border-related enforcement. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which cleared the Senate and House in an expedited push marked in intra-party fighting, includes several provisions aimed at taking additional money out of immigrant pockets, as reported by the Wall Street Journal. Through cuts in benefits and added or increased fees, immigrants, both documented and not, will be paying a sizable amount of the cost to fund the president's agenda. Details of the legislation include not allowing children who are U.S. citizens and have parents without legal status to be eligible for the child tax credit, an annual financial break for families to help defray the cost of raising children. The move is estimated to make 2.6 million children ineligible for the $2,200 credit. Young immigrants protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, will also no longer be eligible for subsidies through the Affordable Care Act. Several other groups of immigrants, including visa holders, will now be prohibited from buying insurance through the ACA. And refugees and immigrants who won their asylum cases, groups of people often fleeing life-threatening situations in their home countries, are also now, under the GOP bill, ineligible for programs including Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps, benefits that add up to more than $60 billion. Those seeking asylum in the U.S. will also now be subject to a $100 application fee starting in fiscal year 2025. The administration's decision to impose this new financial hurdle makes the U.S. one of the few countries that charge a price for seeking humanitarian protection. That's not the only additional fee added to asylum seekers. As the Wall Street Journal notes, this group will also be required to pay $100 for each year they wait in an asylum backlog, $550 each year to renew a work permit, and should asylum seekers want to appeal a denial, they'll have to shell out $900 to have an appeals body review their claims. That same appeal, before the bill was passed, cost $110. Separately, anyone issued a temporary visa, such as a tourist, student, or work visa, will be required to pay a new $250 visa integrity fee, in addition to existing fees for respective visa categories, the Wall Street Journal's Michelle Hackman and Jack Gillum write. Many of these fees, they continue, are written as minimums, meaning Trump or any future administration could jack them up even higher. The bill also introduces a new tax on individuals sending funds to people they know in another country, also known as remittances. In the first-of-its-kind tax aimed at cutting into monies traditionally sent from immigrants to their loved ones, these transactions will incur a 1% tax, down from 5% in an earlier version of the bill. Last month, Republican Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri introduced a bill that would tax remissions at 15%. As Quartz reports, those using a cashier's check, money order, and cash would be subject to the new tax. The remittance tax wouldn't be collected if it's paid with a U.S.-issued credit or debit card. Digital transfers from bank accounts and other financial institutions, as well as cryptocurrency and stablecoins, are also exempt. Currently, crossing the border into the U.S. without proper documentation is considered a federal misdemeanor. Trump's new bill requires undocumented immigrants detained by immigration enforcement to pay a $5,000 non-waivable fee. The legislation also creates a $5,000 fee for immigrants deported at court hearings they don't attend, a chilling addition as ICE officials have been lying in wait to detain immigrants at their court hearings. The government is expected to provide guidance on the timings of these fees within the coming days. If immigrants are unable to pay these fees when the administration demands, the government will have new leeway to bring criminal charges to those who committed a misdemeanor. Those expected additional fines and fees from the new GOP bill add onto an already large sum of monies provided by undocumented immigrants that fund American programs. According to a July 2024 report by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a nonprofit think tank, undocumented immigrants paid $96.7 billion in federal, state, and local taxes in 2022, more than a third of which went toward payroll taxes dedicated to funding programs that these workers are barred from accessing. Following Trump's new bill, undocumented immigrants are poised to pay even more for programs that they either don't benefit from or are directly designed to target them. We're turning now to the Best 11 reports. The first headline, J.D. Vance, sending ICE billions is more important than your grandma's Medicaid. The vice president would like people to see the bigger picture. This is on July 2nd. As you've probably heard by now, the big, beautiful bill currently making its way through Congress is widely unpopular. It's unpopular among voters. It's unpopular among Democrats. It's unpopular among GOP lawmakers who said yes to passing it. It's also unpopular that the richest man in the world, who spent more than $250 million to elect the guy who's pushing to get the bill passed, has threatened to start a new political party if the bill becomes law. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being a bipartisan bill everyone loves, and 10 being a bill people are charitably describing as a flaming pile they wouldn't send their worst enemy, it's a 975. While reasons for hating the legislation vary, two of the very big ones that is projected to, 1, add trillions to the national debt, and 2, make such deep cuts to Medicaid that when combined with other changes made to the Affordable Care Act, an estimated 17 million people are expected to lose their health insurance, a move that would affect everyone from newborn babies to nursing home residents. Meanwhile, the biggest winners of the bill are rich, while Immigration and Customs Enforcement will receive more than $100 billion through 2029. And according to J.D. Vance, it's worth it. While seemingly understanding that he couldn't come out and be all, do it for the 1%, the vice president took to social media earlier this week to claim that exploding the deficit and slashing Medicaid is worth it to increase ICE's budget. That's not like an exaggeration of what he said. That was literally his argument. The thing that will bankrupt this country more than any other policy is flooding the country with illegal immigration and then giving those migrants generous benefits, Vance wrote. The OBBB fixes this problem, and therefore it must pass. Everything else, the CBO score, the proper baseline, the minutiae of the Medicaid policy, is immaterial compared to the ICE money and immigration enforcement provisions. Yes, that's right. According to the vice president, stripping 17 million people of health insurance is but a small detail. Did he consult Joni, We Are All Gonna Die, Ernst, before posting his thoughts? Feels like he might have, but then again, maybe he came up with these gems on his own. Incidentally, the VP who cast the tie-breaking vote to send the Senate version of the bill to the House did not care to mention that the undocumented immigrants are not eligible for most federally funded health care benefits, and only some with legal status may qualify, often paying a premium. Democrats have unsurprisingly latched on to Vance's comments regarding the spending bill. Representative Ro Khanna asked, "What happened to you, G.J. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, now shrugging off Medicaid cuts that will close rural hospitals and kick millions off of health care as minutiae?" Texas Congressman Greg Caesar put a slightly finer point on things. J.D. Vance talks about turning the GOP into a party for working people, but he's the biggest billionaire bootlicker of them all, Caesar wrote. When it mattered, he was the deciding vote to slash Medicaid to bits to pay for billionaire tax breaks. We're never going to let him forget it. Our next 11 report headline, Kristi Noem says Trump is upholding freedom by deporting cannibals. She strangely did not mention Trump's obsession with Hannibal Lecter. This is on July 1st. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem is probably best known for the story she told in her memoir about shooting her family's dog. But shooting dogs is not all she's about. She contains multitudes, okay? For instance, today she shared a story about ICE detaining an alleged cannibal and said cannibal allegedly trying to eat himself. Speaking at a press conference in Florida with Donald Trump, Noam claimed that the president's deportation push, which she is overseeing, is about upholding freedom, the freedom to live safely in this country and to do things legally and to have justice. The administration, she said, is going after murderers and rapists and traffickers and drug dealers and getting them off the streets and getting them out of the country because Joe Biden let the worst of the worst come in here. You may have heard that. According to CBS News, the arrests of immigrants without criminal histories have spiked, and only about 8% of detainees have been convicted of violent crimes. But that's not what Noam wanted to talk about. The other day, she told reporters, I was talking to some marshals that had been partnering with ICE. They said that they had detained a cannibal and put him on a plane to take him home. And while they had him in his seat, he started to eat himself, and they had to get him off and they had to get him medical attention. These are the kind of deranged individuals that are on our streets in America that we're trying to target and get out of our country because they are so deranged they don't belong here. Speaking of cannibals, Trump brought up Hannibal Lecter again last week, reminding people that while campaigning for president, he talked a lot about the Silence of the Lambs character. As he was bragging about the record number of deportations his administration had carried out, he declared, "We're bringing criminals by the thousands. Nobody can even imagine. They let people in that were murderers. 11,888 murderers, gang members, people from mental institutions, and insane asylums. You know what that is, insane asylum? That's a mental institution on steroids." During the campaign, I'd talk about the late, great Hannibal Lecter. Do you know who that is? Hannibal Lecter? Silence of the Lambs? Here's another Levin report from July 1st. Trump suggests he's open to deporting Musk, as Musk threatens some kind of TBD nuclear option. The president and his former first buddy are fighting again. Donald Trump and Elon Musk are fighting again. Yes, less than a month after putting aside their last feud, which involved threats of canceling government contracts and selling a Tesla, accusations of ingratitude, and the suggestion that the president was in the Epstein files, these two have taken up their swords once more. And by swords, we mean their accounts on the respective social media networks they own. Yes, even though they are super well-adjusted and absolutely do not have extreme daddy issues. Yes, even though they always, always put the country first and do not suffer from such acute levels of narcissism that they think things that amount to, the world would be a better place if there were dozens of mini-me's running around, and there should be a parade in my honor. Things kicked off this time when Musk, who previously dubbed Trump's big, beautiful spending bill as disgusting abomination, called for a new political party, writing, "If this insane spending bill passes, the America Party will be formed the next day." Later, he said he would donate to the re-election campaign of Representative Thomas Massie, who voted against Trump's signature bill, and threatened any lawmakers who campaigned on the promise of reducing spending, but continue to vote on the biggest debt ceiling increase in history. That apparently didn't sit right with Trump, who took to Truth Social, the platform he launched after his ban from Twitter, which Musk later lifted, in the early hours of Tuesday to threaten to pull Musk's government subsidies, ranting, "Elon Musk knew long before he so strongly endorsed me for president that I was strongly against the EV mandate. It is ridiculous and was always a major part of my campaign. Electric cars are fine, but not everyone should be forced to own one. Elon may get more subsidy than any human being in history by far, and without subsidies, Elon would probably have to close up shop and head back home to South Africa. No more rocket launches, satellites, or electric car production, and our country would save a fortune. Perhaps we should have Doge take a good hard look at this. Big money to be saved." Asked by a reporter if he planned to deport Musk, Trump responded that he'd have to take a look and that the administration might have to put Doge on Elon, a remark that came with a joke about Musk being eaten. In response, Musk announced that he was tempted to escalate this but would refrain from now, for now. It's not clear what would constitute an escalation in Musk's mind, but given that he suggested Trump was, at best, pals with a convicted sex offender the last time around, it would probably be really bad. Our last Levin report is entitled Usha Vance Dreams of Being Far from the White House, in Ohio, to be exact. This is on June 26th. If Donald Trump abides by the Constitution, and that's a very big if, he will be unable to serve another term as president, and come January 20th, 2029, will have to go home. While many things could change between now and then, maybe Trump will anoint himself king. Maybe Canada will take pity on the U.S. and annex us. Vice President J.D. Vance is currently favored to win the 2028 GOP primary, according to a new poll. What does Second Lady Usha Vance think of the prospect of moving to the White House in 4 years? Well, she doesn't seem jazzed about the idea. During an interview with Vance for the podcast Citizen McCain, Meghan McCain told the Second Lady, "There is not a small chance you could be our First Lady in a few years," and asked, "Is that exciting? Is that something you think about?" To which Vance, sitting in a living room in her new house at the Naval Observatory, responded, "My attitude is that this is a four-year period where I have a set of responsibilities to my family, to myself, and obviously the country, and that's what I'm focused on. I'm not plotting out next steps or really trying for anything after this. In a dream world, eventually I'll be able to live in my home and kind of continue my career and all those sorts of things. And if that happens in 4 years, I understand. If that happens at some point in the future, I understand. I'm just sort of along for the ride and enjoying it while I can." Earlier in the interview, Vance told McCain that she and the vice president called their home in Ohio their dream house and forever house, and it's the place she feels most at home. During a question about date nights, she said, "Being anonymous in public is honestly the best of all dates for us, because that is what a good life is supposed to be like. It's like what a good life is like." Old friends of Vance recently told the New York Times that they're bewildered by her transformation, and that she may be the wife of the vice president, but she must be appalled by the Trump administration's attack on academia, law firms, judges, diversity programs, and immigrants. Vance is the daughter of two Indian immigrants who moved to California in the early 80s. On the other hand, friends told the Times, if the second lady is unhappy, we probably wouldn't know. The vice president himself suggested as much as an event in March, saying that his wife, "I think she's doing a great job as second lady of the United States. And here's the thing, because the cameras are all on, anything that I say, no matter how crazy, Usha has to smile and laugh and celebrate it. Doubly so if husband of the year becomes president in 2028. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you back next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great week, everybody.